but they also created a couple of submarines that were nothing but anti-aircraft guns. You know, these things would have up to six different guns on them. To me, the more fascinating thing is, what if the Germans had used those resources somewhere else instead of building U-boats, built more tanks?
Admiral Dönitz is commander of the U-boat arm and said, look, you know, my boats are out there, but we're finding it harder and harder to pinpoint convoys. They would arrive with what was called the Funkgerät 200, Hohenfiel, which was German for deer antlers, and it was so named because the nose of these big old aircraft would be bristling with dipole antenna.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. We're ready for takeoff.
Welcome to Extended's Coastal Command series. I'm Tim Robertson, and I'm your host for this chapter. In this chapter, we look at the adversaries of RAF Coastal Command, understanding the U-boats and their armament. We talk to Mark Lardus, author of Our Air Battle for the Atlantic from Osprey Publishing. Mark talks us through the different U-boat types and their specifications, an interesting view of the Coastal Command's enemies. We then take a fascinating look at how Admiral Dönitz called upon the Luftwaffe to provide long-range spotting and shadowing unit to act as eyes for his U-boats. Robert Forsyth talks us through how they use their Junkers GU-290s far out in the Atlantic to hunt Allied shipping. We started with Mark and asked him to take us through the different U-boat types.
There were three basic combat types of U-boats deployed during the Battle of the Atlantic. The Type 2, which was a 250-ton coastal boat. The Type 7, which was about 500 tons. And it was the main U-boat that the Germans used. Two-thirds of the U-boats were Type 7s. And then there was the Type 9, which was their cruiser U-boat, and that was rated as 750 tons. And actually, as I recall, the Type 9s displaced 1,200 tons fully loaded. The Type 2 was really only used in the opening phase of the war because the Germans had so few U-boats. But some of the top aces cut their teeth commanding Type 2 U-boats in the first months of the war. Otto Kretschmer, who was the leading U-boat ace, commanded a Type 2 before going on to the Type 7s. The Type 7 deployed 915 tons fully loaded. They had five torpedo tubes, four forward, one aft, and they would carry up to 11 torpedoes. They carry one reload, and then they also had one that they could store externally that they then had to transfer into the thing. Initially, they were armed with a 88-millimeter deck gun and a 20-millimeter anti-aircraft gun, and that was it.
Right.
But this was their main U-boat. This was the one that they used against the convoys, and they were intended to be used for wolf pack attacks. Rudeltaktik was what the Germans called it.
Yeah.
The other boat they had was main boat was the Type 9, and the Type 9 was actually the one that was the most had the most successful warp patrols, although that ended up being the Type 9s attacking individual unarmed American ships operating on the Atlantic coast. But those were about 1,200 tons. They could go 18 knots on the surface. The Type 7s went 15. And they had 6 torpedo tubes, 4 forward, 2 aft, and they could carry up to 22 torpedoes. They were intended to do long-range individual missions, and they were supposed to operate where convoys were not, and where you would not have – they were not intended to be to fight aircraft or really even escort ships.
And was that why the use of flak boats was introduced?
The flak boats were introduced when it became apparent that the biggest threat that the submarines had were aircraft. You know, there's an old saying that when the only tool you have is a hammer, you have to view every problem as a nail. and basically, oh, well, you've got aircraft, let's start shooting at them. So they started up gunning not just the Type 9s, but also the Type 7s. Initially, they would replace the single 20 millimeter with either a twin or quad 20 millimeter. And then what they did was they would expand the superstructure, creating what was called the Winter Garden, which was a platform for more anti-aircraft guns. And, you know, that the, for example, the U-505, which was captured in 1944, had 2 twin 20 millimeters and a single 37 millimeter as an anti-aircraft. Now, that required them to pull the main deck gun, but by 1943, the deck guns weren't being used anyway. But they also created a couple of submarines that were nothing but anti-aircraft guns. You know, these things would have up to 6 different guns on them. But again, the problem is fire control for these things. They all had to be aimed by hand. And if you attack them with enough different targets, the crew couldn't focus on them.
And what would the range of these U-boats be, Mark?
The Type 2 was a very short range, 1,600 nautical miles, and that's round trip. The Type 7 was about 6,200 nautical miles, and the Type 9, depending on which one you were talking about, could go anywhere from 10,000 nautical miles to literally about 26,000 nautical miles. There were some of them with tanks that could literally fuel tanks that they could literally go around the world without refueling. Unfortunately, that's on the surface. Okay. And by the time they were building them, they had very little opportunity to spend much time on the surface. But again, the Type 9C, which was the main one that was used, was about 12,000 nautical miles.
What would a crew size be on a 7 or a 9?
The 9 had a crew of somewhere between 44 and 60, and part of that depended on the anti-aircraft battery, what type of equipment they had. But it was somewhere between 50 or 45 to 60, typically about 54. With the Type 7, it was 42 to 46 men.
Right. And towards the end of the war, and it didn't see a great deal of service, but they developed the Electra boot as well, didn't they?
Right. They had the Type 22 and the Type 23 of what they called the Electra boat, and that was intended to operate submerged. And that had a snorkel system built into it. It also had a lot more battery so that it could stay submerged longer. The problem then, and they built a massive number of these things, but they really did not get into the war because, despite stereotypes of German engineering, they weren't very good at making things operational quickly. They took a long time to build U-boats, and even with the Type 21, which were essentially mass-produced in the same way that the Americans built the Liberty ships and the escort carriers, they couldn't quite get it right fast enough. In 1944, Dönitz canceled orders for several hundred Type 7 and Type 9 in order to concentrate on these, but they were really only coming into operational use in 1945. And even then, they had teething and development problems, which limited their use. What was ironic is by the end of the war, the U-boat service was primarily operating in the coastal waters off of England because essentially it was easier for them to hide. But the problem with that type of a war is you aren't going to win the tonnage war that Dönitz envisioned. Basically, yeah. after really about September 1943, the only reason Dönitz was sending the submarines out was to tie down Allied resources. The survival, success was defined by getting your ship out to where your boat out to its patrol area and getting back. And to a large extent, it didn't matter if you sank anything or not, because it meant that the Allies had to use men and guns to harry the U-boats rather than to attack Germany.
Right. And it was an amazing effort from the German manufacturing sector to produce these things. I mean, they were churning them out.
Yes.
At a rapid rate of knots, weren't they?
Right. But when they were done, you needed another 6 months to bring them to a state where they were operational. I mean, they were throwing them together, but then you'd end up having a punch list with all these flaws that had to be fixed before you could use them in combat.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Some fabulous pictures in your books as well about U-boats being manufactured. And in a bizarre and ironic twist of fate, of course, a lot of the steel and the iron and the other product that was required to build these was coming from Scandinavia, where, of course, Coastal Command at the back end of the war was striking heavily in terms of stopping that supply line. So it was an interesting dilemma.
Right. To me, the more fascinating thing is, what if the Germans had used those resources somewhere else? What if they had, instead of building U-boats, built more tanks? Although they still had the same manufacturing problems and issues with tanks, it was endemic to Germany that they would over-engineer stuff.
Yeah, interesting. An interesting dilemma. Mark, really enjoyed that discussion. Thank you.
Okay.
G'day. I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Turning from below the surface to above it, we now look at how the Luftwaffe took on the role of long-range reconnaissance and get a flavour for German operations on long-range sorties over the Atlantic. As RAF Coastal Command hunted the U-boats, Luftwaffe unit FAG-5 was hunting the Allied shipping. Occasionally, they crossed paths. Robert Forsyth's recent book Shadow of the Atlantic, published by Osprey Publishing, tells the story.
Robert, can you give us the background to FAG 5?
Well, there was the Germans had an increasingly desperate need to really get their U-boats onto the convoys. By mid-1943, somewhere across the Atlantic at any one time, there was a convoy, east or westbound, going down to Gibraltar, to West Africa. And, you know, it's a large tract of ocean, and even a pack of U-boats needs eyes, and remaining on the surface was, you know, for long periods of time was dangerous. And although the Luftwaffe had developed a relatively effective equivalent of what we would call a coastal command, you know, a maritime air force, if you like, it was really geared to just that. It was a coastal patrol force. German air doctrine from before the war and into the war was very much geared toward ground offensive operations. You know, we tend to think in terms of Blitzkrieg and Stukas and bombers and Heimkehr 111s and what have you. But the ability to create a maritime air force was always difficult for the Luftwaffe, and there are reasons for that, competing interests, et cetera, et cetera. But what they lacked was the ability to range far out into the Atlantic. They lacked a long-range aeroplane which could act as literally eyes for the U-boats. And Dönitz, as Admiral Dönitz, as commander of the U-boat arm, regularly banged the drum and said, look, you know, my boats are out there. We're doing the best we can in very difficult conditions, but we're finding it harder and harder to pinpoint convoys. And so eventually the decision was taken, and there was some reluctance on the part of Goering and the Reich Air Ministry, the RLM, to do this. But eventually a decision was taken, well, okay, let's give them a group, a unit of long range aircraft and see what they can make of it. And the Luftwaffe had already done this to a very limited extent. There was a unit called Kampfgeschwader 40, KG-40, which operated the Focke Wulf 200, the Condor, you know, pre-war airliner, wonderful aeroplane. And you know, that was conducting offensive operations against shipping, Allied shipping and convoys, but it didn't have the legs, it didn't quite have the range. So happily, Junkers, the firm of Junkers, had developed a pre-war aircraft called the JU-90, which was built as the Condor was, as a pre-war civilian aeroplane, as an airliner. And basically, the JU-90 became developed into a larger four-engine aircraft called the JU-290. And this sort of happened at the same sort of time as all the background was about the maritime air war over the Atlantic was taking place. So the aircraft was there, and the unit formed. And so FAG-5, which actually means Fernaufklärungsgruppe 5, Long Range Reconnaissance Group 5, was formed at Aachener in the summer of 1943. And the unit was basically formed with some very experienced, skilled reconnaissance pilots who'd served on the Eastern Front. Again, really land pilots, but very experienced reconnaissance flyers. And they were pulled together as their units were disbanded and what have you. They were brought into Germany, and they were told to report to Aachener, and an officer called Hauptmann Fischer, again an experienced reconnaissance pilot, was put in charge of the unit, and the group was formed at Aachener. They trained up on the JU-290, which was a very big, very comfortable, very accommodating aeroplane, four BMW 801 engines, bristling with machine guns, could accommodate a crew of up to 10. And after a relatively short period of time, the unit was transferred in the autumn of 1943. It was moved gradually, but by the autumn of 1943, they were getting ready for operations, and the base that was chosen for them was a place called Mont-de-Marsan, which is on the French Atlantic coast, north of the Pyrenees. It was a grouper, as it is in its name. It was a grouper-sized formation. The basic Luftwaffe, if you like, the sort of the chain of command was the highest tactical formation was a Geschwader, and depending whether it was fighter, bomber, or whatever the line of service was, you would have anything from, you know, 60, 70, 80, or 100 plus aircraft. A Geschwader was then broken down into Gruppen, 3 to 4 Gruppen, usually of 30 or so aircraft, and the Grupper was then broken down into 2, 3, 4 Staffeln, depending when in the war it was and the arm of service, et cetera, et cetera. And a Staffel could be 10, 12 aircraft, depending on serviceability. So for Nachtclub, FAG 5 was a grouper. And yet, because this was such a big aircraft, and really they didn't have many, and when they got to Mont-de-Marsan, they literally only had a few serviceable aeroplanes, but they formed up the Staffeln, and Mont-de-Marsan was the base from which they commenced operations.
Robert, and what was their role, their mission and their objectives over the Atlantic?
Yeah, basically to act as two things, to act as the book is titled, the wrote, titled Shadow of the Atlantic. They were known as shadowers. And that effectively means they were shadowing convoys. So they were acting as eyes for the U-boats. What they would do is report the presence of enemy shipping, and they would relay that sighting back to either U-boat headquarters in Wilhelmshaven or Paris, or back to their own airfield at Mont-de-Marsan. And the hope was, in very crude terms, we spotted a convoy, over to you guys. It's at location 123. We'll track it until you can get your U-boats or your pack there, and we'll keep you informed of the location of the convoy, and then it's over to you. That was the theory.
And this was done over radio. That was very long distances, wasn't it?
Well, it's incredibly long distance. And the thing that gets in the way is, of course, you're talking about winter weather. Operations really kicked off in the first half of 1944. So you're talking about January, February, March, right out in the Atlantic, right beyond the west of Ireland, or down to the northwest coast of Spain, down towards Gibraltar. So these guys were a long way from home, and it wasn't a direct link to the U-boats. As I said, they had to radio signal the position of a convoy, which would then be sent to often a booster point in France to be bounced to Wilhelmshaven or wherever the U-boat command was. It did shift a bit for various reasons. The communications chain did shift a bit, and then back out to the U-boats at sea. And so, yes, it was a very, and you know, when the weather deteriorated, it was bad. You would often get malfunctioning equipment on board the Junkers. So there were lots of hurdles to overcome. But actually, the unit did report hundreds of thousands of tons worth of shipping. The problem then was whether the U-boats could, for whatever operational reasons, get to the convoys.
And they had elements of technology on these aircraft. They had radar, and they had homing buoys as well that sent signals out to the U-boats. How did that work?
Yes. Yeah. Well, initially, so when operations commenced from Mont-de-Marsan, initially they had nothing apart from the Mark 1 eyeball. And as I said, some of these crews had been flying Junkers 88s for long-range reconnaissance over Russia. Now, you know, flying over land looking for T-34s or trying to spot a Soviet troop assembly or a bridge or whatever is one thing. Trying to spot a convoy in foul weather, often in darkening conditions, way out into the Atlantic is another thing altogether. You know, talk about a needle in a haystack, it's another thing altogether. Nevertheless, these were very experienced observers. And in the first stage of operations, the first aircraft they operated, the early J-290s they had, it was literally the Mark I eyeball. And everybody on board, the pilots, the navigators, the gunners, particularly the gunners actually, flight engineers, they would all, you know, contribute towards scouring the sea. Eventually, as more aircraft slowly trickled in from the Reich, they would arrive with what was called the Funkgerät 200, Hohenfiel, which was German for deer antlers, and it was so named because the nose of these big old aircraft would be bristling with dipole antenna, and it was a ship search radar, and that certainly shifted things up a gear. It gave them the ability really to pick things up in foul weather. And weather, you know, again, I can't stress that conditions in the Atlantic, you know, early in the year were generally pretty foul. So the Fug 200 did actually assist them. And then later, and I'm afraid it's the common thread in German wartime aviation, too little, too late. But later, they had a radio buoy, a droppable buoy that they would drop, called the Schwan, the Swan, and it would float in the water. And they would drop a buoy as close as they could get to a major convoy, and that would float. And the German U-boats, singly or in packs, would home in on the buoy. But that came in quite late. And again, the technology was there, but it was still early and it wasn't working terribly well.
And you talked about long duration flights, long missions. What sort of heights did these aircraft fly at? Because there are reports in the book of some very low level flying.
Yeah. Well, you know, they would take off and climb up to normal, you know, they would go several thousand, you know, feet into the air at normal operating altitude as they crossed the Biscay, or down to the coast of Spain, or out to the west coast of Ireland. But once they were actually in the process of tracking, or they'd found a convoy, or they got close to a convoy, these guys would fly right down on the deck, because the other thing they had to do, and this is the unbelievable thing, the other thing they had to do was to avoid being detected by Allied radars, and also to avoid being spotted by the Allied ships. So if they could get as low as possible to literally hugging the waves, they could see better because they were lower and therefore, in theory, closer to their target. But they weren't expected to be flying that low, if that makes sense. So they would literally creep up on a convoy. It's amazing. These guys took these things right down to the deck, and looked for convoys. It's quite incredible. And then once they done the job, or if it was a futile mission sortie, and they, you know, whatever, they would then gradually climb back up to a higher altitude, and then fly back. And of course, one of the most dangerous parts of the mission was actually not out at sea looking for convoys. It was actually coming in across the Biscay, because that's where Coastal Command, Allied VLR aircraft were, you know, bow fighters, liberators, you know, carrier-based, fighters.
And we've mentioned these long duration flights. These crews were highly experienced, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. I mean, some of the pilots that flew were pre-war Lufthansa pilots. So, and they were chosen because Lufthansa in the late 1930s operated some pretty long range routes. And a couple of the pilots had been on those long range routes, you know, going out to the Far East, flying, you know, long range German aircraft, you know, Fokker Wolf Condors and things like that, that were Lufthansa operated. And, you know, they had been in terms of military flying, they had been flying since Poland, since 1939, some of these guys. And the thing with FAG 5 is there weren't very many novices. You know, sure, you'll get a gunner that you know, may have joined the Luftwaffe in 1941 or something, but he was still a well-trained gunner. But the pilots and the navigators, flight engineers, you know, this thing was a big aeroplane. It was out on missions of 12, 13, 14, sometimes, you know, 18 hours. And you had to draw on your wing fuel tanks. You had to know when, you know, you had to understand how fuel tankage systems worked. You had to have great stamina. You had to understand the aircraft. And so, yeah, you couldn't just bung a novice crew in. So, yeah, some of these guys were very, very qualified men and pre-war Lufthansa flyers.
And what was a normal crew made up of?
Well, when I was researching the book, I got some Junkers documents, and in fact, the authorized crew was nine, but in fact, they would fly with 10, and sometimes they would fly with 11 crew. So, because of the duration, and in case of injury or wounding, you couldn't just have one pilot. So there'd be a pilot, a co-pilot, there'd be a navigator, an assistant navigator. There'd be three up to four gunners. There'd be a flight engineer, and sometimes two flight engineers. And they would take it in turns to rest, to fly. You know, it's very, as there is an account of a couple of these guys said this when I was writing the book, that, you know, the stamina needed to combat boredom is quite, you really, you know, fighting boredom is a big thing. And, you know, keeping your eyes peeled the whole time over endless grey ocean looking for small ships, you really had to have stamina as well as being a skilled aviator.
And a lot of caffeine.
Well, they certainly took, yeah, they took a lot of coffee on board, and they had thermos flasks and they had dried food. And one of the crew would be nominated as a cook. You know, the later models, when you got up to the A5s and the A7s, they would have a toilet on board. They'd have very crude bunks. You know, they were well stocked with medical provision, you know, medical supplies. They were, you know, the Luftwaffe took care of them, but there's only so much they could do. You know, once they left the ground and they were out of the Atlantic, they were on their own. And the other thing is they operated only one aircraft at a time. And then tactics emerged so that it was realized that they would fly out. Often they would, when they had sufficient numbers of aircraft, they would fly in two pairs of aircraft, so that one aircraft would, for a period, be deployed and actually looking for the convoys. The other aircraft would fly nearby and keep an eye on the sky. And they actually were, the Junkers 290 was a surprisingly maneuverable aeroplane. You know, there were clashes with Mosquitoes and Bow fighters, and invariably there were times when JU 290s got shot down. And the weather, but on the other hand, the bad weather was on their side. And some of these things would just give some of these Junkers would give a Mosquito or a Bow fighter a run for their money, and indeed got away. They'd also fly over neutral Spain as a sort of evasive maneuver or as evasive tactic. That didn't always work out, because a couple of JU 290s were lost, you know, crashing in Spain, flying into Spanish hillsides.
And there's reports of a 2-hour air battle between the group and Coastal Command aircraft.
Yeah.
What's known about that air battle?
Well, that was in February 1940. I think that's a clash you're talking about, in February 1944, if memory serves me correctly. You know, the the Allies had introduced very long-range aircraft. Mosquitoes and Bow fighters would take off from Cornwall, from I can't remember, is it Pradanic? There's an airfield in called Pradanic.
Saint-Yval,
yeah. So there were Bow fighters and Mozzies. And there was one day in February 1944 when a squadron of Mozzies were up, as well as a squadron of Bow fighters. They were literally flying south, patrolling the Biscay, and some Ju-290s, I can't quite remember right now whether they were on their way out or they were on their way back, but off the coast of Spain, the two, and you're only talking a couple of Ju-290s, but these two Ju-2, again, they were operating as a tactical pair, but these two Ju-290s ran headlong into a formation of a group of Mosquitoes and Bow fighters. And these things just wheeled around the sky. And there was a pilot called Bergen who basically, again, you know, comes back to what you were saying earlier on, very, very skilled airman. You know, they literally flew to evade. And for a considerable period of time, Mozzies and Bow fighters were chasing these two Ju-290s along the coast of Spain until eventually I believe one got shot down, if I recall correctly, but the other got back. And, you know, you'd think, well, surely if you're in a Mosquito and you've got this great lumbering four-engined aircraft that's probably going much slower than you, you know, surely the Mosquito's gonna get it. But no, I mean, these guys, and not just on that occasion either, there were other occasions where these guys managed to give fast twin-engine RAF fighters the slip.
Fascinating air battle, that. Just to sum up then, Robert, what would you say Fag 5's impact was on the Battle of the Atlantic?
In all honesty, a pinprick. The unit did what it set out to do, and it accomplished what it set out to do. It spotted, I think it was, you know, it was several hundred thousand tons worth of shipping. It was the U-boats that couldn't connect. It was time and again, these guys spotted convoys and reported back. Occasionally, as we've said, you know, the radio link, the communications link was not always good. It failed. But those guys, they had their ship search radar. They were qualified airmen. They were experienced airmen. They found the convoys. And wherever they could, whenever they spotted them, they reported back. And it did work. But it was the U-boats that, for various reasons, didn't finish the job. And I'm not a naval historian, but I can tell you certainly from the Luftwaffe end, they did the job. But the net result was that ships didn't get sunk. So in true real terms, Fag 5 did not have an impact on the Atlantic War, if that makes sense.
That really is a fantastic insight. Thank you so much, Robert. Of course, the book is The Shadow Over the Atlantic, published by Osprey Books. Thanks, Robert, for giving us such an interesting insight to Coastal Command's adversaries.
Pleasure.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. Just as Extended is currently expanding your knowledge of RAF Coastal Command, you might be keen to widen your aviation history horizons in other directions as well. Did you know, for example, that around the time the Short Sunderland was entering RAF service, Shorts were breaking with their flying boat traditions and planning a long-range advanced land plane airliner? The project was halted on the outbreak of war, but you can read all about it in our latest edition, TAH 37. Did you also know about the British South Africa Police Reserve Air Wing, established in 1957, in which farmers and businessmen flew anti-guerrilla missions in their own civilian light aircraft, fitted with door-mounted machine guns and homemade grenade chutes? Or that Italy's mighty Isotta Fraschini Asso 750 aero engine an 18-cylinder broad arrow monster introduced in the early 1930s, which developed 850 horsepower, is still in production as a marine engine today, 90 years later. You can read in depth about all of this in issue 37 of The Aviation Historian and extend your knowledge. We're print, we're digital, but we're not on sale in newsagents. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com.
So that's chapter 6, looking at RAF Coastal Command's deadly adversaries. Of course, there are so many other challenges RAF Coastal Command faced, but we hope you enjoyed this insight into a few of them. In the next chapter, we explore the roles of Australian, Trinidadian and French-Moroccan aircrew who served in RAF Coastal Command. You can find me, Tim Robinson, at RASTimR on Twitter, and you can find Gareth, Peter and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. Please leave us some feedback on this series and engage with us to debate and discuss the role of RAF Coastal Command in World War II. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Tim Robinson. And remember to stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, aerospace radio station, Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
The cockpit's very cramped. You've got leg restraints on. You're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.